evening, everyone. Welcome to Yada Yada Radio. Almost missed the show myself this evening. Just pulled in.
We were hoping.
We were hoping I'd miss it. Okay. I've got some questions for you, Larry. This is my first question for you. If we were reliant exclusively on the Masoretic text, to what degree would we be able, if we were diligent, to be able to accurately deduce what Yahweh conveyed to us in his Torah, prophets, and so on, if we were reliant on the Masoretic text?
Maybe 80%. I don't know. I would hate to do that, but okay. I'm not
I know the answer. Kirk, do you have a guess?
Well, I'd say it's closer to 95%, but you couldn't miss the Berea Covenant Agreement.
Okay, so and James, what do you think? We got an 80 and a 95.
I'd say 100%. You'd miss some details, but Yahweh is so repetitive in his message that even with the Masoretic, I don't think you could miss it.
Okay. I did, just because I was curious, several years ago, since we have the entire book of Yahshua. I noted, first I counted every word, and then I counted every word that was different in the Masoretic text versus the Great Isaiah Scroll. And what I found is that the Masoretic differed from the Great Isaiah Scroll in one word in every 14. One word in every 14 is below 90 percentile. Yeah, about 93 percentile, something like that. But that's not totally fair.
No, it's not, because then you've got pronunciations and all kinds of things.
Yeah, of those one word in 14, three-quarters of the differences were in whether something was singular or plural, whether it had one mood or another, whether it had one stem versus another. Many of the changes were in whether or not there was a conjunction. What I'm trying to say is that somewhere around 70 to 75% of the differences between the Masoretic text and the Dead Sea Scrolls were nominal, not significant enough to preclude somebody from being... disrupt the message. All right. So if you realize that it was only... that just in terms of the Masoretic text, you're at about 93%, and then you realize that of that 7% that is different, that 5 of that 7% is insignificant. The variations are way too small to be of concern. So now you're up at around 97 to 98%. That's pretty high. All right, but the Masoretic text is from a family of scripts that left Israel around 500 BCE and were maintained in Babylon.
In Babylon, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, you have another set of texts that were found in the 1950s called the Dead Sea Scrolls, found in the caves of Qumran. Now, they are interesting. Yeah, they're interesting because they are from an entirely different family. Those texts were maintained in Yisrael. And so they are not just another repository of text. They are from they are as far different in terms of who maintained them and where they were maintained as you could possibly be from the Masoretic text. Plus the Masoretes were rabbis, and the Essenes were not. All right. So now with the Dead Sea Scrolls, we have about a third overall of the Torah, prophets, and Psalms in the Dead Sea Scrolls, and so that 2% material difference, the Dead Sea Scrolls resolve somewhere in the range of 75 to 80% of that. So now you're at 99%. And you're and maybe even higher than that for two reasons. And one of the reasons is what JB said. which is God tells us his story from so many different perspectives in so many different places, and it's always
hard to hide.
That even if you're missing half of 1% and it's wrong in one place, he's given it the information to you in five other places. So
well, at least three.
The bottom line is, so long as you're willing to look past the diacritical markings of the Masoretic text and look at the letters themselves, so long as you're willing to be thorough in your approach to it, so long as you're willing to view everything from the perspective, from Yahweh's perspective, we have the ability within the Torah, Nambi, and Mizmor to be 99 and maybe higher. I would say, if I were giving an answer here, I think that the 100% number that was given is probably the best number. We are so close to 100%.
But, J.B., aren't you something?
Yeah, he's something else. Yeah.
Okay. Now, I did this for a reason. I read this for a reason. First of all, I wanted to embarrass Larry. No, I'm just kidding.
Well, thank you.
I did this for a reason. And the reason was, I came to a conclusion today that is really stark. It is way beyond anything that I've ever even contemplated before. But I began to think of Mizmor 19:7. That's one of the passages we talk about the most. The Torah is perfect, absolutely complete, and lacking nothing.
That's right. That's what it says.
Capable of restoring souls. Yahweh's restoring witness is easy to understand for those who are open-minded. Now, for the first part of that to be true, you don't need anything else. Correct?
Right.
If we're going to take Yahweh at his word, if he says, my Torah is complete and lacking nothing to restore your soul and to bring you home.
It's lacking nothing.
And it's lacking and nothing. What more do you need? Are you capable of understanding precisely what Yahweh is offering by way of his covenant through the Torah alone?
Yes.
Yeah. Do you need anything else to know that there are five terms and five benefits to the covenant? Do you need anything beyond the Torah?
Oh, sure.
Well, you need one thing. You might put it, the other thing that the Psalm mentions, you need an open mind.
But if all you had was the Torah, would you be capable of understanding who Yahweh is and what he is offering by way of his covenant and what you specifically need to do to capitalize upon it?
Without a doubt.
In fact, I would go so far as to say, is there any place outside of the Torah that the terms and conditions of the covenant are presented?
No, not at all.
Okay.
Because that's
right.
In Korah.
Now,
that's
where is Yahweh? Because the third condition of the covenant requires us to walk into Yahweh's presence so that he can perfect us, which is the Mikre. Where are the Moed Mikre presented?
Korah, in the Torah.
The Torah.
Yeah. Where are the dress rehearsals for the Moed Mikre so that you might understand them? Where are they presented?
Throughout the Torah.
Where are the Moed Mikre explained?
In the Torah.
This is an easy test.
Yeah, really easy test. Do you need anything more on the Moed Mikre in terms of understanding what they represent, understanding what the invitation is, who the invitation is written to, who wrote the invitation, what you're being invited to capitalize upon, or how it relates to the covenant? Do you need anything beyond the Torah?
No, you don't. No.
No.
Obviously not.
Do you know from the Torah, based upon what Yahweh did for Abraham on Mount Moriah, in terms of providing the sacrificial lamb and promising to do so on Pesach, do you need any information that's in the Christian New Testament.
No.
You have to understand that Yahweh did that for us.
No, Yahusha didn't sport a New Testament. That was invented much later.
Would you even be able to know the timing he did it based upon what he said about the fourth day of creation, about the greater light becoming visible
to us as a sign of the Lord. And it's also built into the home, the Baith out there, you know, where the sacrifice is made at 4,000 cubits. Right there is where you made the sacrifices. Sure.
All right.
It's all right in there. It's built
so when Yahweh said, now I happen to love, I mean, capital L, I mean, I love the Psalms. You know, as I've made it very clear, I have a man crush on Dode. I just think Dode's the coolest dude ever lived.
Well, he's the guy that told us how to really view the Torah if we wanted
that,
to.
That works
right?
for me. Now you understand. Sure. And, you know, and the beauty of Dode is that, you know, I don't have any difficulty noting that well, I'm a flawed dude. I ain't as flawed as he is. And so being flawed, being good, obviously doesn't mean squat.
No, it doesn't.
Being right with God. Doesn't mean squat. Yeah,
Tzedak is where it's at, being right.
Yeah, Tzedak's where it's at, man, being right. And don't figure that out. And so that's the reason that I'm really cool with Dode. Now, I'm really happy that we have the prophets and the Psalms to with the prophets, absolutely verify without any question whatsoever that Yahweh is God and that he inspired the words that we have been considering. And there's so many marvelous insights presented in them. And and of course, the Mizmor are just, particularly those, are just extraordinary in telling us, giving us the right perspective to look at all of these things. But the bottom line is, are we capable of knowing exactly what Yahweh conveyed in the Torah and of capitalizing on the offer of the covenant with nothing else?
Of course. That was what he said. He said not to focus on his physical appearance.
Okay.
And now he says that later in Yahshua Yahweh. I'm going to share
the history of the English Bible, because it's going to lead to the conclusion that I'm going to share with you now. Larry, let me ask you another question. I'm going to give you a chance now to redeem yourself on this one, Larry. I know it's important to you. Do we have a copy of what Yahusha said in the language that he said it amongst?
No.
That can be found anywhere. Do we have a single example?
No, not a single line, not a passage, not anywhere.
We don't even have a line.
Right.
Even a sentence.
No.
Do we have the Torah, the prophets, and the Psalms in the language that they were revealed?
Yes.
100%, right?
Yes, absolutely. Yep.
So we have the Torah, prophets, and Psalms in the language that God revealed them in. Do we have a single word? Well, we have a couple of words. Maybe. Who knows? But do we have a sentence from Yahusha in the language that he spoke, Hebrew?
No.
Not a word. We don't have anything.
We have to rely on hearsay evidence.
I'd ask you this question. If God wanted us to know what Yahusha said and did by way of an eyewitness account to him doing it, would we have at least one record in Hebrew?
We'd have the entire record if he wanted us to. That's right.
Yeah. Now, God doesn't make any claims that he's going to intervene in the maintenance of said records. But he absolutely says
the opposite. He said they will corrupt them.
Right.
What he
absolutely. Said. But
he made it so they were going to be corrupted.
Yes. But by the way, if you look at his Hebrew, you know, it has, by the standard of Yahweh, perfection, yes, it has been corrupted. Has it been corrupted to the point that we can't figure it out? Absolutely not.
No, we do that all the time.
Right.
We figure it out. Sure.
Yes. With Yahusha's words and deeds, is it possible to figure out what he said in Hebrew? Only by reverse engineering, right? By assuming that whoever the translator was from Hebrew to Greek, because I
actually did a good job.
But by the way, they didn't. We have absolute proof that the translator did a crappy job. So recognizing that, you're having to do a lot of interpretation.
You're on thin ice, and I wouldn't count on it. That's what I would tell anybody.
Right. Yeah. Now, let's go to the next step. Do we have a single reliable, just forgetting Hebrew, now let's go to Greek.
Okay.
Do we have a single reliable ancient record of what Matanyah wrote or Yahweh Kamen wrote?
No,
from
not
the first
really.
Century? From the second century? No?
Yes.
No?
Well,
we don't.
From the second century, we have Greek, and it doesn't read anything like what we see there.
Yeah, from the second century, we have some Yaokanen, but, it's...
We don't have any Matanyah.
We don't have Matanyah. Yaokanen, okay, I can take it or leave it.
Like Apophis is an example. That would be a good one.
But Apophis is a revelation. Do we have revelation in Hebrew?
No, we do not.
No, we don't. No, we do not. Do we have an early complete copy of Revelation?
No, we do not.
Nowhere close. We don't even have this from the 17th chapter on. We don't even have anything prior to Constantine.
Yeah, and that's bad news right there.
That is bad news. Why I'm unwilling to devote any significant effort to trying to translate it, or one of our covenant members said, there's a discrepancy in Revelation versus what we read every place else. A multitude in heaven. And they said, what's your take on it? I don't have a take on it. I can't resolve it for it because I'm not even going to.
A lot of people even get hung up on that 144,000,
right,
which we don't even know if that number exists or what it's about. It doesn't even make sense, actually.
Because it's not Hebrew, because it's been very poorly maintained, because we don't have any ancient text, there is no way to be even approach having confidence. Lorraine, how many discrepancies are there between the oldest 69 manuscripts of the so-called Christian New Testament?
You mean out of 180,000 words, there's 300,000 known.
Right. Okay.
Just pathetic. Yeah.
Is that close? Well, I don't know how to run a percentage on what 300,000 variances in 182,000 words.
A negative number.
I don't even know how you run a variance on... maybe there's a way to do it. I don't know what it is. Okay, so.
Well,
Yahweh made it very clear that he was not going.
Is that it's 164%
to preclude men from corrupting his testimony? But when you recognize that we have two families of texts on the Torah, prophets, and Psalms that are 95% concurrent when you look at the things that are important. Do you think that over a period of all of that time that maybe God managed to make certain that we would have access to what he says?
Yes, I do.
I do too. Now, is there any such thing with Christians, and whether it's the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the of their Old Testament, or their oldest text in Greek. Is there any such thing? Is there any family of codexes that are even remotely consistent or accurate?
No.
So either God didn't give a crap and never had any involvement in it, or he had no concern whatsoever whether or not it was not just corrupt, I mean, twisted to the point of being wholly and completely unreliable. Now, if you want to be resolutely rational, based upon the comparison between Yahweh saying, my Torah is absolutely complete, lacking nothing relative to the restoration of your soul. And then there is not a single endorsement from God, not one, not from Yosha, not from Yahweh, regarding even the conception of a renewed covenant, or anything about any one of the authors of the text. There is not a single place where God says, hey man, this is my word, man. This is scripture. You ought to pay attention to this. You're getting it right from the horse's mouth right now. This I want written down because it's coming from me. Is there any place where God says that?
No. No, he says the opposite, though. He says I will never divide my covenant. There's only one. He says the exact opposite of that.
Yeah, and he made it very clear that when he actually does renew his covenant, the renewal of his covenant is going to be the only difference between the existing covenant and the renewal of his covenant is that with the existing covenant, the Torah is outside of us, and we have a choice to whether or not to accept it and to study it and to observe it. And upon the reaffirmation of his covenant, the Torah is written right inside of us. So it becomes literally part of us. That's the only difference.
Yep.
So is there any chance that what the Christians have and they claim is a New Testament, a new covenant, can be the one that God was speaking
There's no
through.
Chance that's
You're
correct.
Me?
No chance. Yeah. Or God's a liar. You
right.
can take your pick. I had a conversation with a woman today, and I told her exactly that. Either God's right, or mankind is right, and you take your pick.
Take your pick.
That's the end of it.
Yeah. So, this is the conclusion, and I want to go through the evidence to demonstrate it.
Okay, and do me a favor. There's two things I want to share real quick before
okay,
you...
Let me finish. I'll give you the conclusion, and we'll listen to you share, and then we'll go into the evidence for it.
Sure.
I'm convinced that the reason that we do not have a copy of anything Yosha said and did in Hebrew, which is the only language that Yahweh reveals his nature and his plan, and the only reason that we do not have a text like we have with the Dead Sea Scrolls or even the Masoretic that can be relied upon to convey what he said and did is that God had absolutely no intention of us having anything from that period. And the reason he had no intention is because everything we need to know is already included in the Torah, and the Torah is sufficient in and of itself, and that if he gave another testimony, he would be breaking his own rule by adding to it, and most important, that by creating a new source of information like this, that he would be creating the possibility for a new religion, an entirely new interpretation, something that he absolutely did not want. The Christian New Testament isn't just of man. It isn't of God.
Well, yeah, we know that.
God did not want us to
focus on his fulfillment of it. Exactly.
Yes.
Well, it's clear to anyone who spends any time reading the Greek text that these were not people sitting there writing down what he was saying as he was saying it. These were written years later. It's obvious from the writing of the text that these were written as an afterthought years later.
With the exception of Revelation.
Can you tell me which book among the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms was written as a personal letter?
All of them.
No.
Oh, a personal letter.
What,
I thought you meant personal letter
what,
from Yahweh.
What letter? What part of the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms begins as, you know, dear Timothy?
No.
Which one begins like Luke began the book of Luke, where he's saying, hey, you know, I've done some research, and I want to share my research with you in a letter.
None of them.
None.
These
which,
are all.
Which
I'm,
one of the
I'm Torah, Zachar, Prophets, Yah, and the word of Yahweh come to me.
This is my account of what happened.
None of them.
Which of them was written by somebody who was not a witness to the events?
None of them.
Which of them was written without God speaking in first person?
None of them.
None of them.
There is nothing in the Christian New Testament that compares to anything we find in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms.
No.
Right, that's why he said it's complete and perfect.
It'd be as if God completely changed his style overnight. Just, you know, I'm going to do this for, you know, what, 3,000 years, 4,000 years? This is my way of communicating with man. Now I'm going to change.
Right. And, oh, by the way, not only am I going to change my language of communication, not only am I going to change the way I communicate through man, I'm also going to change and come up with an entirely different message that conflicts with everything that I had previously said and did.
No, I have a question.
So the Christian New Testament, not only is of man, it is not of God.
Right.
Which, yeah,
well,
what's
we
your question,
that.
Kirk?
Yeah.
And then we're going to...
I was going to ask you a question. Could it also be the reason that he allowed that garbage of the New Testament to exist because it becomes a choice like the tree in the garden?
Absolutely.
Well, that's free will. I mean, that's just God, free will, yeah.
God does. Has God ever stepped in the way and said, you know, Jews, you can't be religious, or Gentiles, you can't be religious?
Absolutely not.
No.
Never once.
Yeah.
So it's not a question of him allowing. He never stands in the way of man being religious.
If you want to be stupid, he allows you to be stupid. Yeah.
Correct.
Okay.
Well, you want to be stupid, he will not stand in your way. He doesn't care.
The reason I said 70% isn't because it was 70% understandable, and I really should have directed
actually
out exactly
said,
what you
80,
said.
Actually, you said 80, so you did.
Yeah,
80%. I was thinking in terms of traditions, too. Because once you throw traditions in, you've got it all screwed up. It's over with. And that's why I wanted to share this because I felt like this is a way of really explaining Torah. If I created a farm and the food was very special and it had life-giving qualities, okay, food that would amplify your abilities, your perceptions, and provide you with eternal life.
Oof.
And further, if on paper I explain to you how to get to that farm, providing accurate details, what religion would that be? And before you answer that, could you get there by having faith or belief in food? Could you get there by worshiping food? And could you get there by bowing to food?
Showed up there, would your first instinct be to bow to the great farmer?
No, I'd be there. I'd thank him. Thanks.
Thanks.
That's what I'd say. You better believe it.
Yeah.
But that's it. I mean, that's it.
Yeah, the first thing I would get there, if I went there, somebody said, listen, I have food that's going to sustain your life forever. I have food that is so nourishing that it'll cause you to be able to understand. Your brain will function so vastly better than it does now that you will understand the profound truths of life. The first thing I would do is when I got there, I'd say, how did you come to these realizations? What was it that enabled you to produce this kind of food? And, of course, your answer would be, it came from the Torah. The instructions on what was nourishing, what was life-sustaining, what was enlightening, what was invigorating came from the Torah. I simply planted the seeds that I found in the Torah. And then I'd say, you know, I'm glad I came to meet you, but really all I really had to do was open the Torah, and I would have found your farm, wouldn't I?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, I'm just, you know, I'm making a point. The Torah is a map. There's directions. It's got nothing to do with bowing to food or having faith in food. And that, there was another thing I wanted to point out. I'll just do this real quick. I was watching a commercial came on in between an ID show I was watching, and it said the name of the show was The Original Sin, Sex. Now, I went into the Torah. And I looked. I looked for this original sin.
Right.
I ended up making a note called, I'm a sexual prude, yet I'm a whore. You betcha. You know. And God
the original
down
sin. Now, by the way, for someone to conclude that the original sin was sex, they have to be completely and totally ignorant.
Yeah, they're insane.
All right.
And God knelt down next to them, saying to them, be fruitful and multiply.
By the way,
be fruitful and multiply. Only one way I know to multiply.
Yeah. Do you think that Yahweh created Chawa for Adam because he wanted to create something for Adam that would not be sexually desirable and attractive?
Yeah, he made her.
That was his goal. He failed.
They just left that out.
That was his goal. He failed miserably. Okay, so
if God did not want men and women to multiply, he should not have made women look so good.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
What was actually the first sin?
And listening to
adding to God's word and taking away from God's word.
There you go.
Changing God's word.
Yeah, which is what we're talking about tonight.
That is what Hasatan did. Hasatan came into the garden, and he asked Chawa a question, and he made a statement. And what he said, he took out of context and twisted. And Chawa then responded by adding things to it and misapplying Yahweh's testimony as if she had not actually heard what God said. And so it was corrupting God's testimony that was the first sin.
Yeah, okay. Now, I'm going to ask you another question here. How many wives...
Sex, but there you go.
Right. How many... Well, it's called not listening to Yahweh's instructions
by the way,
Torah.
If the first sin was sex, why is God's favorite person of all time a guy that had so many wives? I don't even think he knew their names.
That's the next question.
Yeah.
Okay. How many wives did Dode have? Wasn't it seven? And then he had three mistresses.
When I was starting to read Chronicles, the first thing you get to is he had like seven or eight sons from the first six or seven wives, and then they were saying, and that, by the way, does not count the children that he had via his concubines.
Yeah, his mistresses.
I don't think that,
is what they're called.
Yeah, concubines. You have mistresses. I don't think that Dode even knew the names of all of the women that were part of his menagerie.
Okay. And how many wives did Jacob have? He had two, but then he had kids with two of the handmaidens.
Handmaidens.
Yeah.
And Abraham, didn't he have two kids? One with Sarah and one with his handmaid.
Well,
right.
Got remarried and had three kids. Through another wife.
But I'm saying when he was married.
And by the way, didn't Moshe get flack from Aaron and Miriam because he not only had an additional wife, but that wife was black.
How horrible.
Didn't they flack? And didn't Yahweh said, since you seem to be so enamored with white, how about a little leprosy here?
Yeah, right. Yeah, but I want to point something out here.
Humor. Yes, okay.
So Moshe, Dode, and I'm going to throw Moshe in there now. Dode, Jacob, and Abraham, amongst many others, could not hold office in many of these religious outfits today. And of course, being whorehouses, they wouldn't want to.
Yeah. By the way, that is not an example that I recommend.
Well,
wives are good. One is good. Two are not better. I personally.
I'm saying.
But that's just me. It has nothing to do with God.
Many examples.
I think it's a beautiful way to put
it. And it never worked out well for them.
I don't care. This is the way I am telling you. This is the way that I'm telling you. None of them could hold office in a religious institution today. And when Yahweh is talking about whorehouses, he's not talking about sex. That's my point to the note.
The whore of Babylon is not a person.
No, it is not.
No, it's Satan.
Anyway, I just had to. I wanted to bring those points up because I'm just tired of hearing, and you hear it all the time. We see it all the time. It shows a sexy woman in a bikini eating an apple and so forth.
And that all comes from Paul. The whole anti-sex thing stems straight from Paul's writings. There is nothing anti-sex in all of the Torah prophets and writings.
That is correct. It's Paul who was a sexual pervert. by his own admission, by the way.
Yes, sure.
The person that imposed this notion that because sex was of the flesh, that it had to be bad.
Gnosticism.
Yeah, so it all grew out of Gnosticism. Oh, by the way, you know, the proponents of Gnosticism, the Greeks, did the Greeks have a problem with sex?
Oh, no.
No, they didn't. In fact, they liked a lot of little boys.
Yeah, they had a problem. They weren't having enough.
Yahweh does have an issue, never with sex in the sense of sex for fun, sex for procreation, but he didn't even have a problem with sex for fun. I mean, Joe did not have a harem unless he was having sex for fun. God doesn't have any issue with sex for fun. What he has an issue is the perversion of sex.
Yeah, rape.
He never says. He never tells you that perversion of sex is fornication. He never tells you that perversion of sex is sex outside of marriage. What he tells you is that perversion is sex with a child, sex with your mother, sex with another man, sex between two women, sex between any relation in terms of your family. Sex with an animal. Those are the things which God says, those are perversions. And so God's issues are only a perversion of sex, where it's not just that what you're doing is counterproductive for you, but what you're doing is harmful to somebody else.
Yeah, and I agree with that. I mean, that's why I pointed these things out. Dode was not committing pedophilia or incest any more than Abraham was.
No,
so, I mean,
no, and he wasn't having sex with another man. But by
no,
way,
no,
he was
absolutely.
Sex, by the way, if he was having sex with another man, wouldn't have mattered. So long as he didn't make an ongoing practice of it, he and Yahweh would have been fine over it.
Yeah,
I mean,
well, I understand.
I mean, Yahweh does
perfect,
have a, you know,
perfect,
you should not commit adultery.
Right.
And you know, I mean, how do you even count adultery when you've got someone like Dode with a harem, and when you've got someone like Dode who had his general sent off to battle to be killed, so he could have ongoing.
Well, then we go back to the whore of Babylon. I understand adultery. What that is chasing after false gods. I get it.
You know, by the way, one of the things that is communicated a lot by theologians is that the reason that Dode could not build the temple was because of the God's frustration with him over Bathsheba. No, it isn't. God told him. God told him. Yeah. God told. Yeah. God told.
Because he killed people.
Dode exactly why he was not going to be able to build, not by the way, the temple, the home.
Yeah.
It's because you're a man of war.
Yeah.
You know,
I get it.
My family is not going to be built by a man of war.
Yeah, that's right.
All there is to it. You're a man of war. That's about
Now, where did they
killing.
Come up with this?
And my family.
How did they come up with this Bathsheba thing? How did they come up with that? Because that's
and
not what it says.
Sex is about having children. That's the end result. War is about killing them. So, yeah, I was
right.
I'm not going to criticize you on the sex part here, but I'm going to tell you, you're not going to build my home because your life has been way too preoccupied with killing. No, God's story really makes sense. You read things that he has to say, and you say, oh, wow, yeah, well, that makes sense. That's consistent. That resonates. But this idea that God would create, I don't know if you've ever seen the Robin Williams thing on God creating all of these parts for men and women, and then saying, "Hey, that feels good. You can't do that." You know that.
No.
You know, I designed it.
Yeah, you know, I get tired of that.
I've seen that.
Yeah,
but no, I get tired of that because nowhere when he's talking about the whore, he tells us this is how he tells us to deal with the whore: by being observant, you'll be protected from the illegitimate, estranged, authorized, sickening, and repugnant woman. Away from the whore's seductive words and deceitful promises. He doesn't say keep your pants on. That's, you know, he's saying you observe you know, and you see what's illegitimate and unauthorized, as an example, taking letters that were written hundreds of years after the fact and stuff like this.
Yep.
You know, by the way, well, I would say that Revelation was a word-for-word dictation
to think about
here, screwed
because
up.
We're talking about Goad here, and we're learning from him, and that might seem like, okay, we're applying lessons that we're learning outside of the Torah. And I say, no. When the Torah, well, what does it mean?
It means directions and teachings. It doesn't mean just five books.
All right. All right. Is there prophecy in the Torah?
Yes, mm-hmm. There is.
Is all there teaching? Or is there teaching in the prophets?
Yes, indeed.
Oh yeah. So what is the difference between the
and
Torah
prophecy.
And the prophets?
None.
Yeah. What is the difference between the Torah and prophets? If there's Torah,
they were written later.
And the prophets, yeah. And there's prophecy in the Torah. How would you distinguish between them?
Well, I don't.
Yeah.
No. So the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, Mizmor, and really the, I use the term that Yosha used, Torah, prophets, and Psalms, with the Psalms reflecting all of the writings. And there, you know, if you look at Tanakh, the Hebrew acronym, they rather than Mizmor, they use the Hebrew word for writing so that they get Tanakh as opposed to Torah, prophets, and Mizmor. But the fact of the matter is that there's profound prophecy in all of the writings, and there's teaching in all of the writings, just as there is prophecy and teaching in the Torah and prophecy and teaching in the prophets. So they are Yahweh's testimony from Bereshith 1:1 all the way through the end of of Malachi is one document, one thing. And it is sufficient and completely nothing.
Well, he said that you'll know it's from me. We've been through this in Dabarim because I prove it. I verify it.
Right.
I verify it with prophecy.
Do you find Yahweh's name anywhere in the Christian New Testament?
No.
Not
in order to remove it. Yeah, now you remove
it. Is it written? Right. Is there any book that Yahweh inspired in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms that does not include his name?
No, not one.
No.
Not one? Not one? Not one. And then all of a sudden you're supposed to have another group of them and they don't include his name?
Well, it's not only that, but
literally in a language that cannot pronounce his name.
Well, it's not only that, but I think Revelation was word for word dictation. I do believe that. I believe
but in
that.
Hebrew,
but in Hebrew, exactly. I'm not saying what we have of it is accurate. We know for a fact it's not, because you look at the pre-Constantine papyrus and look at what's in a Biblia today, and there's a book named after two sun goddesses, the Holy and Biblius.
Right.
You know, so there's
way. In one of the introductions to the open letters, you find in Yahweh's voice, Galatia, Cherith.
Oh, boy.
There is a 0% chance he said it. None.
No, I knew. Yeah, given opinion. I was actually talking to a woman today, Sharon ITG and yada yada with her, that I pointed that out. I had to explain to her what the graces were.
And
she was very accepting of it, you know, and she's actually going to read them, so I hope. It'll make a difference.
I was involved in a very interesting journey. I've been on this journey now for about 3 weeks. And the journey was, I wanted to, after a departure, I had translated and commented on the entirety of Yahshua, Isaiah chapter 1 and chapter 2. And really, I was profoundly amazed that God basically said three things in the entirety of the first two chapters. First, I raised my children. I did everything I could to nurture them, to lift them up, to care for them, to empower them, and they rejected me. And they rejected me in favor of religion. and
that's
religion
right.
has made them stupid. It's made it. It is absolutely religion has incapacitated them. And even in spite of the fact that they have been religious, I have still made certain that my signs, my Zion, have been posted along the way. So they're there, even though my people have rejected me for religion.
Yeah,
and then in the first statement in the third chapter, and I, you know, every time I talk about chapter and verse, I cringe because Yahweh did not have chapter and verses. One
right.
fluid thought. But as we, you know, I'm referencing it just so people know where I am. But in the first statement of it, Yahweh said, I'm removing, behold, I'm removing my provision. Pay attention now. I am removing my provision to uphold life.
Yeah, that's right.
And so what you have, you're immediately confronted by the fact that God is saying that the provision that I have to withhold life is not accessible to those who are religious. That's the only connection you can draw from the first three chapters. I am withdrawing it. And I decided that I would devote a month to A, verifying, affirming, not just, you know, I'm of the tendency to say, what's God's provision to uphold life? Well, it's the covenant. Okay, yeah, it is the covenant. Prove it. And so I decided I was going to prove it. And then I decided that God had provided a powerful word in Henna that was extraordinarily profound in the way that it was written, in the way that it was used, and when it was used, that tells us that is the perspective, that's the attitude, that is the approach that we need to take if we want to avail ourselves of the provision that has been withdrawn at large. And so I began to write this chapter. And I began to write this chapter based upon searching every place that henna was used in conjunction with a provision for life. Now, the first time is just interesting. And Kirk, 2 weeks ago, you brought this up.
Mm-hmm.
Yahweh uses henna in conjunction with food, making a statement that would be absolutely irrelevant unless food symbolized something other than what plants and vegetables.
Animals.
Yep. And so that's the first. But then the next one that I went to was in, because it's the, it's the one of the clearest, most profound stories on the substance that upholds life. And that's what was being withheld. So the story of Noah, why God was ending the life for most mortal men and taking away what he had given them, and why Yahweh was preserving the life of eight souls. If henna appeared there, and it does, it's in the 13th statement of the sixth chapter of Bereshit, then I knew we would have something profound. So I would begin there, and then what I did with the rest of the chapter is I went through all seven meetings that Yahweh had with Abraham and covered each of them where he uses henna to prove conclusively that the covenant is the only thing that matters in terms of God's provision for life. And then I recognized, well, of course he's going to use henna in his presentation of the life-saving ark with Noah, because the agreement that he made with Noah is the first presentation of the covenant. So, what I'm going to share tonight is just the first, and we're not going to get through with it. I mean, we're not going to come close to getting through. But if I'm right about this, and I have a lot of research here, so I'm going to be talking a lot, bear with me, interrupt anytime you want. But if the conclusion that I've made is right, that God never intended for there to be a Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, anything associated with the Christian New Testament, that he did not inspire it, he did not authorize it, it's not from him. It is wholly and completely unnecessary. As a matter of fact, it may even be counterproductive because it has us look at the diminished manifestation of Yahweh as opposed to Yahweh himself. If that conclusion is correct, that is profound. It goes way beyond the point that I have come to. And I've told you many times that there's a lot of positions that I have that are very extreme, and I'm not telling anybody that they should agree with my position, but one of my most extreme positions is that Yahusha is very, very close to being irrelevant. Now, I understand that he is a diminished manifestation of Yahweh, that he fulfilled Pesach, Matzah, Bekodim, and Shavuot in conjunction with the set-apart spirit, and that is extraordinarily relevant. But Yahusha is nothing more than a diminished manifestation of Yahweh.
Well, that's what he says. He says it. Yahweh agrees
right.
with him.
They both agree. I think you just look right through him, right past him, to Yahweh. So when people get all excited about, Hamathiach, what's your position on Yahusha? That means squat to me.
Well, when I go to a page and it says Hamashiach, I get out of that page because all they're doing is focusing on a diminished manifestation, which he told us not to do, and it's never written Hamashiach anywhere.
You look at Yahusha, every time somebody asks a question, what do you say? Go look at what it says in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms.
He always pointed to Yahweh. Look at the one that sent me.
What are you doing?
Don't ask me, stupid. Yeah.
So, I'm already of an extreme position there. But if the conclusion that I came to today, based upon 15 pages of historical research on the nature of the Christian New Testament, if the conclusions I've deduced from it are true, if they are in fact reliable and reasonable, then it goes far beyond us not paying attention to Yahusha and looking past him to Yahweh and recognizing that Yahusha is nothing but a tiny fragment of Yahweh doing what Yahweh promised. Then the entirety of the Christian New Testament can be tossed away. It has no value whatsoever. Now that is an extreme position and maybe even too extreme for many of those who are listening tonight.
Well, you had that position years ago, and it's grown now, and you think you're more confident in it. But when you start calling them a toenail clipping, and I can agree with it because of the context of what you were saying, then absolutely. And he only used him as a vehicle.
By the way, toenail clipping is not
He created him for that thing, and it's still Yahweh.
The relationship between Yahusha and Yahweh is not as significant as the toenail clipping to a person. He is far less representative of Yahweh than a toenail clipping is of an individual. That's just the facts.
Yeah.
Yahweh is a seven-dimensional construct.
It is so far
Yahusha, Yahusha's body, which was essentially irrelevant, is automatically reduced by the square of the speed of light.
When you're talking about physically, you're absolutely right.
It's an infinite reduction to go from seven dimensions to six, infinite again to go from six to five, infinite reduction again to go from five to four, and we're talking about three.
You're right in that regard. But when it comes to the fulfillment of the Moed, then it's huge. So I don't know. I can't agree with you to a point, but I disagree. For one thing, even though we don't have revelation in Hebrew, I believe that was dictated to Yahochanan. That's why I said not to change a word, and of course we know they did.
But it was dictated to him in Hebrew.
Yes,
and we don't even have a Greek manuscript that is even remotely reliable, and the most important part of it is the end of it, and we don't have the end of it in any manuscript within 400 years of the time that it was spoken.
What we have
is maintained by people who are absolutely untrustworthy. So what's the difference between it being said and us knowing what was said? I mean, The delta in...
You're right. You're absolutely right. I'm not going to disagree with that. I mean, you're right. So
here's what happened. I started reading, because I'm a stickler for context. I think if you don't have context, you can't understand. So while the henna, which was the word I was pursuing, is in the 13th verse, we're only going to cover here initially the first four, and then we're going to go off into a historical investigation. This is the first four statements of Bereshit 6. Indeed, when the defilement and flame, the profane nature, the contemptible attitude, and disgraceful wounding of the descendants of Adam came to exist on an ongoing basis, it increased dramatically, growing to the point of being multiplied greatly in a myriad of ways, reaching into tens of thousands with them shooting arrows at one another within the area and before the presence of the descendants of Adam. And daughters were born to them, and the sons of the Almighty saw that the daughters of Adam indeed were desirable and valuable. So they grasped hold of them and took for themselves women from any which, as a result of the relationships, to benefit their ways, they chose. Then Yahweh said, "My spirit shall not remain nor abide with the descendants of Adam forever. Because in addition to this, he is Bashar, he's flesh, and prone to proclaiming, publishing, and preaching news, which is considered good and beneficial by those who hear it. For a period of time, it shall come to exist that his days shall be limited to 120 years. Now, God has just said that his spirit is not going to exist with man, because man is not only promoting religious, but because man is profane, contemptible, disgraceful. For a limited period of time, the Nephilim, those who prostrate themselves and are stillborn, falling in prayer, falling in battle, and falling in status, who are militaristic and thus meet with an untimely death, existing in the region in those days, but also those bearing a resemblance to them in a slightly different form for some time thereafter. By associations, the sons of the Almighty came to, making a habit of pursuing the daughters of man, the female descendants of Adam, and they conceived children for themselves. These warriors and political leaders, prominent individuals with the ability to fight, who prevailed in their quest for military and political power, who were from a relatively long time ago, were individuals with reputations and recognizable names. Bereshit 6, 1 through 4. Larry, how many times? Kirk, James? How many times have you been told or asked who the Nephilim were and thought that somebody came to the conclusion that this was about...
They were giants.
Not only were they a race of giants, but they were made a race of giants because spiritual beings came down and had sex with earthly women.
The Book of Enoch people.
Everybody.
I think J.V. put to bed pretty badly, yeah. But with his breakdown of the Book of Enoch, yeah. Which is a campfire story, at least 100 times. At least.
Yeah, I've heard it so many times, and every time somebody says, well, what's your take on the Nephilim or Nephilim? I said,
they were really bad people.
Lisa did a breakdown on that. Do you know they were all tied, the Nephilim were all tied to the sun, the moon, and the stars? Can you think of three religions that might be?
Yeah. But you know, what I did here is I decided, you know what's important here is to define the word. You know, when it's presented in the text as ha Nephilim. Mm-hmm. So ha Nephilim means that it's a title. It's like the presidents. It's like the Americans, the Babylonians, the Egyptians.
Yeah,
it's a
right.
Title slash name.
Now, and they prostrate themselves, meaning their religious.
Titles and names, you know, there's, whether it's a title or a name in Hebrew, there is a consistent approach that, that needs to be followed if you're going to be honest and forthright. You always transliterate the letters so that the name can be conveyed in the language that you're translating it into. So you always transliterate the name. So Ha Nephilim, transliterated into English, is Ha Nephilim.
The Nephilim.
Yep. So what is that? Yes, so the Nephilim. That is correct. But with Yahweh, every name, every title is based on a word that has meaning that explains that name and title. So, if Nephilim is plural with the YM, and now you're just dealing with Nephel, you may think there is a verb, like Nephal, that might explain the nature of the Nephilim.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah. So let me share with you what I think the verb means, and then Kirk, correct anything that you hear that you think is an accurate. I have defined Nephilim as those who prostrate themselves and are stillborn, from the verbal root Nephal, to fall in prayer, to fall in battle, to fall in status, going from a higher position to a lower one, those who are separated and die, those who bow down, falling prostrate, to worship something on the ground, those who neglect and are thereby neglected, those who attack to conquer in an offensive military action, becoming inferior in the process, those subject to miscarriage, and thus untimely death.
Mm-hmm.
Anything you think I added there that I should be careful on the miscarriage and the untimely death, because there is the verb Nephal and then there's the noun Nephil, and the verb Nephil and the verb Nephal and the noun Nephil are written exactly the same way in the Hebrew text, and the noun means miscarriage, to truncate one's life. Yeah. So so I did add both.
The nouns are almost always based on the verb.
Yeah. Correct. Yeah,
but
a miscarriage of justice leading to stillborn children, lifeless children, is part of it. So they were involved in a religious, and they were the living embodiment of the second statement Yahweh etched in stone, where he said, you know, the fathers corrupt their children, the third and fourth generation. Their religion was causing a miscarriage of justice, whereby their children were stillborn.
Yeah.
So that's an aspect of it.
Right.
So what do you think, Kirk?
Well, you got that. I found that the fallen pregnancy and abortion because of untimely death.
Okay, so you found the miscarriage stuff too.
Yeah, all that
stillborn
stuff.
Stillborn death, you mean?
And,
stillborn
if
death.
If you add an M in front of it, you have what's thrown down as worthless. What does that say about? I wrote in my parentheses. What does that say about people that ask you to bow down?
Yep.
You've got vermin. You've got. To fall from a erect position. So, I mean, there's also bully and tyrant from Nephilim.
Yep, there is.
The Nephilim.
Yep.
So
well, that's where you got into the militaristic end of it.
Right. And then,
falling. Well, it's primarily falling prostrate to worship, bowing down to worship.
Mm-hmm.
It absolutely conveys falling as an act of war, you know, being killed or killing. As an act of war. So it's falling.
You know, that's
not
interesting,
just in worship. It's falling in the sense of bowing, but it's also falling in the sense of military action, and as a result, falling in status, because God's not the least bit
impressed. But that's interesting, too, because in nearly all military situations, and I'm not saying there aren't atheists or whatever in the military, but primarily you do this for God and country and sacrifice.
Right. And God is saying,
you know, it's all tied in together.
Did you think
that's the thing I love to hear.
He says, Not yet. God said that these Nephilim existed in the land in those days, but also by comparison, in a slightly different form, they existed for some time thereafter.
That's
what would
right.
be the difference?
Yeah.
What's the difference between the Nephilim and the Babylonians? The Assyrians.
Very little.
Very, very little.
The Canaanites.
The Egyptians.
The Carthaginians. The Greeks. The Persians. The Romans.
The Americans.
The Americans. What's the difference?
Very little.
That's why,
very little.
Wagam Acher Ken, which means also by comparison, in a slightly different form, they existed for some time thereafter.
Okay, I have a question.
Yeah.
You've got three groups of people that are on Earth at the time of the flood. You've got Adam's line. You've got Cain's line, who married into the people that existed there without a Nesama.
Right.
You've got the Nesamalous people to begin with that may not have been married into that. So you've got
right.
these three groups. And the question we had at lunch, Terry was wanted to know, and I wanted to know, we were discussing and trying to figure it out, is when did religion start? Did it start, did they have, I know I've seen the cave paintings and I've seen what the Australian Aborigines have and so forth and the shaman type of things. They imply that there was a religion way back when.
No. Oh, religion started way before a man with a Nesama.
Okay, that's okay. that was her point.
Yeah, you had the cavemen worshiping the sun.
Right, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
And then it just got very sophisticated, I guess, by the time Cain gets married to one of them.
It goes back 10,000 years. Right around
okay, so then you have an Nesama person in bingo, and now you're really on steroids.
Oh, that's right. Oh, what God says is that with the Nesama, what he's inferring here is that, because he'll use the Nesama later to explain all this is about the Nesama, the misuse of the Nesama. But what he's saying is that once that in that environment with the descendants of Adam, once these perverse and violent and deadly behavior began, it grew exponentially. And it was the Nesama that caused it to grow exponentially. Yeah. The difference between the cavemen and the crude drawings and the like that go back more than 5,000 years ago, and what we're witnessing here is that now religion was structured, it was organized, it was integrated as a part of government. It was written down so that we can study it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's this idea we're fighting for God and country. Now there was no difference. There was no difference whatsoever between the military and the religion. The military, the religion, and the politics were one. With all
probably
of
not Babylon.
All right. So let's consider why every early English translation misrepresented Ha-Nephilim as a prime example of why we should be suspect of everything published by a Christian institution. Their renderings of Genesis 6:4 are wrong, stating something that is absolutely and unequivocally untrue. They all say giants, that there were giants in the land. There was no race of giants. In fact, the average height of man is substantially taller today than it was 5,000 years ago, by almost a foot. Moreover, by misrepresenting God's message, the essential lesson he was conveying relative to mankind's propensity to be religious and deadly, necessitating the flood, was lost on every reader of an English Bible. So I'm going to read again what Yahweh actually said, and then we're going to consider the translations. There were for a limited period of time the Nephilim, those who prostrate themselves and are stillborn, falling in prayer, battle, and status, who were militaristic and thus met an untimely death, existing in the region in those days, but also those bearing a resemblance to them in a slightly different form for some time thereafter. By association, the sons of the Almighty came to making the habit of pursuing the daughters of man, the female descendants of Adam, and they conceived children for themselves. These warriors and political leaders, prominent individuals with the ability to fight, who prevailed in their quest for military and political power, who were from a relatively long time ago, are individuals with reputations and recognizable names. The last word is Shem, so you've got to throw in names. If you don't, then you are misleading. So, as I was looking at the English translations here, because every early English translation, and the preponderance of them even to this day, say that there were giants in the land. And I said, how do you get there? Every connotation of Nephilim.
I don't even know where they get that. I don't get it.
Every single one of them is about being diminished, falling, being dead.
Yeah, but hardly giant. It's the opposite of giant.
It's the opposite of giant. Like, I even read this Christian apologist that said, for those that, don't accept the King James as the authorized word of God, and they don't because of it rendering Nephilim as giants, then here's proof that they were right. The Septuagint says giants. The Latin Vulgate says giants. All five English translations before the King James says giants.
There's proof.
Five translations after the King James all say giants.
That's not what it says.
That they were giants. Anyone ever says, nobody knows what a Nephilim is, but we sure as hell know what a giant is.
Well, they get that from the Midrash, the Jews, the rabbis.
Oh,
that's where they get it from.
I said, how? Yes, we know what giants are. You don't know what a Nephilim is because you never studied Hebrew. But
there were no giants.
So if God said there were giants in the land, he lied. He lied. There weren't. We know that for fact.
It'd be in the fossil record all over the place, pal.
Oh, you betcha. Yep. Now,
that comes from the Midrash. I actually had it out with the...
No, it doesn't. Does not come from the Midrash. You know when the Midrash was written?
Well, yeah, it had to be. You're right. It was written after
11th century.
You're right.
I'm going to devote the time that it takes to wrestle this beast to the ground. So my first instinct was, because this is so old and so pervasive, that my gut told me that the first place that the error appeared was in the Septuagint. So, the long litany of errors, and especially the notions of giants, began with either an unjustified translation or a careless copyist associated with the Septuagint. Brennan's Septuagint's translation of Genesis 6:4 errantly reads, "Now the giants were upon the earth in those days, and after that, when the sons of God were wont to go in to the daughters of men, and they bore in parentheses and italics children to them, those were the giants of old, the men of renown." Now, as you know, there's absolutely no justification etymologically in paleontology, in anthropology, in archaeology, or ancient history. Just
a picture of them.
Not one. Nowhere. No picture. No fossil record. No paleontology, no anthropology, no archaeology, no ancient history, and most certainly no justification etymologically in the Hebrew text for giants. And yet they used it not once, but twice. And there is absolutely no value whatsoever of transliterating the name without explaining it. I said with the King James, who in the hell knows what a Nephilim is? I'm sure as hell know.
You have to explain it. I mean, we've got somebody in here saying Nephil means offspring of the sons of God. Well, the sons of God would have been.
Who are the sons of God?
No, it doesn't.
I asked him that. He hasn't given me an answer yet.
He's always sideways with everybody.
If you don't know who's talking, then you, and what his intent was, from Yahweh's perspective, Adam was his son.
Right. That's right.
Humankind exists for a single purpose, and that's to be the sons and daughters of God. That's the only reason
we exist. Can you name anyone else who God ever refers to as his son other than man?
Yeah.
This idea that sons of God met angels is ridiculous.
Yeah, I know one
never
man.
Never once does he ever refer to them as his sons.
Yeah, he says that Dode is my son. He said Yosha was my son. I'm his father. The intent of creation was for mankind to engage and be adopted into Yahweh's family as sons and daughters. Yahweh's sons are the descendants of Adam who elected to participate in the covenant. That's who they are. Period. Now, okay, so here's the... So the first thing we did there is the Septuagint. That's when the mistake first appears. Now, there is absolutely no justification etymologically to render Nephilim as giants. There is absolutely no value whatsoever of transliterating the name without explaining it, especially based upon what God told us about them. Factually, the statement, now that giants were upon the earth in those days, is absolutely false. So either the translation was wrong or the author was wrong. Moreover, without an appreciation of what it means to be a son of God, all manner of misconceptions are possible, some of which we will witness in subsequent translations. Further, Haya Baha Eretz is much more accurately translated existing in the region than were upon the earth. The reason that is so important here is God is talking about the descendants of Adam. And he uses Ha-Adam. Ha-Adam is the descendants of Adam. And if he wanted to use just man, it wouldn't be prefaced by the definite article. And he has a lot of words for mankind that don't include Adam's name. And in this particular place, at this particular time, this is the problem. This is where the flood occurred for express purpose, which is to end the lives of all but eight people within the Nephilim. It is in this region where the descendants of Adam live. And that is why rendering it in this region is so important. It's absolutely vital for understanding. Now, the phrase, Wagam Asher Hen, is trivialized by after and after that, destroying the reason for its use in its text. Yeah, the Nephilim didn't live after that. The Nephilim were gone in the flood. The flood is the thing that he is announcing. The Nephilim didn't exist after the flood. So Yahweh is telling us that the religious and vicious tendencies of the Nephilim would continue to be manifest in other forms for quite some time. And indeed, he was right. Halak, whose primary meaning is to walk, is commonly deployed to convey to go. But bow, which was used here, means to come or to pursue. Moreover, if the intent were to say, we're wont to go, the verb would have had to have been written in the volitional mood. But it wasn't. Likewise, El means to. Had God wanted to say into, as in, you know, they're trying to play off the, you know, the more vulgar come, C-U-M versus C-O-M-E, so they wanted to say they came into these women. But he didn't use in, Bach. He used L, too. So they came to, they pursued these women.
I'm not talking about sex.
He pursued them for a reason. They had an asoma. Now.
Yep.
The Septuagint's translation.
But you have to. But let me just throw something in here. What I find is the greatest, you know, riff where people can't get this is they don't understand the difference between Nefesh and Nesama. That's, you know, you have to understand that. If you don't understand that, you're hopelessly lost right there.
That is correct. Yeah, Nesama, this whole discussion is about Nesama. Now, I am telling everyone in advance that it's about Nesama. He hasn't mentioned Nesama yet. He concludes it with Nesama. And since I've read the end of the story, I know this is all about Nesama.
Right.
And actually, the fifth verse proves it. It said that, you know, man's reasoning had become so jaundiced, so corrupt, that is the literally defined the nature of the Nephilim and those who would be like them and would come after them. And the next statement, and he does so by attacking man's reasoning and man's tendency to conceive religious schemes. So, the Septuagint translator ignored the definite article ha preceding Adam and failed to convey the fact that Adam was the name of the first man Yahweh created in his image. There is no reason to write children in italics, which means that it was added for readability without justification in the text, and yet Yalad means to conceive children. Now, why Gibor can be rendered mighty and powerful, it does not mean giants. The most accurate translation in this context is instead warriors and political leaders, prominent individuals with the ability to fight who prevailed in their quest for military and political power. This depicts the point that Yahweh was making in reference to the Nephilim, and the one he will confirm in the next statement. And finally, while it is possible to extrapolate Shem as renown or reputation, what's the primary meaning of Shem?
Hashem is the name.
Name.
And every translation, including the Septuagint, didn't mention name. They had recognizable names. That's what he's saying. Look at all these kings. I mean, we all know Nebuchadnezzar, right?
Yeah.
Yeah,
we know,
yeah, that's right.
We know the Pharaoh
Ramses.
Ramses, yeah.
Doesn't matter. Pick one.
Yeah. Imhotep.
We any one of us can name 10 to 15 Roman
emperors. And they always get their name right.
Right.
Hadad.
Yeah. Julius Caesar.
Absolutely.
Julius. Name.
Constantine.
That's the point I was making. Therefore, as is the case with almost every attempt I have evaluated of rendering a Hebrew statement in Greek, the Septuagint translator failed miserably. Either Hebrew concepts are difficult, if not impossible, to accurately convey in Greek, or the Greek scholars who attempted these translations were inadequately schooled in Hebrew, or both.
Yeah,
more to the point.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'd say a combination of the two.
I agree. Mm-hmm. More to this point.
Well, I just think, don't you think scribes, I mean, for one thing, most scribes don't even know Yahweh. I mean, you know
of
that.
Of course.
And,
not one of these Greek scribes would have known Yahweh. Not one.
No.
Let me throw in something. This next point is really important. Greeks were not only the most xenophobic race in recorded history. They universally hated Yehudim and their language, Hebrew. They thought that Yehudim and Hebrew were the lowest form of life and communication. They still do. That's part of the problem here. The culture and attitude of the Greeks viewed their language and their culture is vastly superior to the language and culture of Yahweh's chosen people and language of Revelation. They were predisposed to say it's their way, to have it their way. Now, the reason this is important is because English Bible Old Testament translators and translations are a product of the Greek Septuagint.
And Roman Vulgate.
As it's reflected in the Latin Vulgate. Mm-hmm. Repeat that. The reason this is important is because English Bible, Old Testament translations are a product of the Greek Septuagint as reflected in the Latin Vulgate. Now, as for Latin, the only people who could rival Greeks in their overt animosity toward Yehudim and Hebrew were Romans.
Oh, absolutely.
If we were to search the world for the two most inappropriate languages and cultures to communicate Hebrew ideas, we would find nothing worse than Greeks with Greek and Romans with Latin. The moment
that is right.
Something in Greek or Latin written by somebody who is a Greek or Roman, you know that there is almost no chance whatsoever that they would be predisposed to convey what Yahweh said through his people, Yehudim, in Hebrew, accurately.
But academia loves Greek.
So, of course.
Can I bring up just one perfect example here, just real quickly? Okay.
Sure.
Do you remember when they make for one thing, they love making a mockery of Yahweh's words, this giants, you know. That's how they invent atheism. But, you know, when Yahweh took Abraham and he pointed at light and he says, your offspring are going to be like that light.
Yeah.
And then what you get in the Biblia is, your offspring are going to be more than the number of stars. So, by the way, they make Yahweh a liar. Because, I mean, as you appropriately point out, there's billions of galaxies with billions of stars in each galaxy. There's only been 8, 9, 10 billion people ever walked the planet. So right away, Yahweh's a liar. Instead of conveying what he really meant, which is that your offspring are going to become fourth dimensional, like light. They're going to become more like me. Instead of conveying what he said, they make Yahweh a liar. Unless you believe God's a liar, you have to believe that translation is wrong.
He took him to the spiritual realm and showed him that he was going to be light. And when Abraham recognized this, Yahweh said, I'm going to consider that sufficient for him to be considered righteous and vindicated. Yes, it's a powerful statement when done the correct way. Now, we have 90 seconds left, and we're going to not go too far into the, you know, like the last time we went an hour beyond our time. But I do want to share with you what's in the Septuagint, and then I want to promise or at least hope that we continue along this vein, because I think there's some powerful insights here. As I anticipated, rather than translating the Hebrew text, Jerome replicated the Septuagint's mistake in his Latin Vulgate. The first word he wrote was giantess. Giantess autem errant, super teram and diabolus iblis postcatum. Let me translate what he said. Now giants were upon the earth in those days. For after the sons of God went in to the daughters of men, they brought forth children. These were the mighty ones of old, men of renown. His Latin Vulgate, which was the de facto Christian Bible for 1,000 years, was a direct copy of the Septuagint and not of the Hebrew text. Now, in a moment.
Right. That's right.
I will reveal the long and sordid history, and we're going to do this next week, of the English Bible translation. But before we do, I want to share what the earliest and most recent have to say regarding Bereshit 6:4. Wycliffe was the first to translate the Vulgate into Anglo-Saxon, which was a precursor of English, on behalf of the common man. He dutifully rendered the Latin text into the language of his age. He said, "Soothly, giants were on the earth in those days. Forsooth, after that, the sons of God entered in, O the daughters of men, and those daughters begat. These were mighty of the world, and famous men. They were the mighty and famous men of the old world." What he did as he translated the Latin Vulgate. He was very clear on that. He translated the Latin Vulgate. And you read what he wrote. He translated the Latin Vulgate. The next to publish was Tyndale. He composed the following. And now, next week, we're going to go through and we're going to talk about what each of these people did, who they did it for, why they did it, and what they used to accomplish their translations.
Good.
And we're going to go through in great detail the creation of the Textus Receptus. We're going to go through in great detail to talk about the corruption of the Septuagint. We're going to go in through in great detail, and we're going to quote Jerome and Origen. And we're going to say exactly what they wrote prior to engaging on their project. And then we're going to quote Erasmus, who was the guy with the Textus Receptus. We're going to quote him, too. You're going to find out what these men actually thought, and it is frightening.
Yeah, don't show up if you can't take it.
If you don't want
to... There's a reason that Yahweh says not to put words in my mouth I didn't speak, especially when you're using the names of foreign gods like Biblia and Holy.
Yeah.
Those are foreign gods.
Yeah.
You know, if people don't want, and I've got a note called "You're Smarter Than God."
Yeah.
You know, there's a reason that he says these things. Now we can either seriously look at these. I mean, you talk about a big signpost. You talk about a sign that's knocking you in the head. You know, when you're running around using the names of foreign gods and saying these are the words of God. I mean, are you stupid? I mean, I guess he just wrote it because he just didn't have anything else to do. Just wrote it. It was just a joke. It's a joke.
That's what all of these are. The next to publish was Tyndale. He composed. There were Tarantes in the world in those days. For after that, the children of God had gone into the daughters of the men and had begotten them children, the same children who were the mightiest of the world and men of renown.
Oh, boy.
Now, while it might be natural to assume that Tyrantes meant to be tyrant, as in ruthless people, since the Tyndale Bible renders the same word in Bamidbar, Numbers 13:13, as giants, we'd be closer to the truth with the assumption that his intent was to depict beasts who were frighteningly terrible. The third oldest English Bible was claimed by Cloverdale, although he copied Tyndale word for word, both in Genesis 6:4 and Numbers 13:13. Thereafter, we find our next four English translators slavishly returning to the familiar pattern of the Vulgate. Without exception, they all replicated the same mistake initially found in the Septuagint and thereby echoed in the words of Wycliffe. King Henry VIII's Great Bible reads giants, as does Queen Elizabeth's Bishop Bible. The resolutely Protestant Geneva Bible, demonstrating its adherence to the Latin text, proposed, there were giants in the earth in those days. Yay! And after that, the sons of God came into the daughters of men, and they born to them children. And these were mighty men, which in old time were men of renown. The first Roman Catholic English translation of the Latin Vulgate, of course, known as the Douay Rheims, offered... Now giants were upon the earth in those days. For after the sons of God went into the daughters of men, they brought forth children. These are the mighty men of old, men of renown. The Septuagint all over again. Now, proving that the King James Bible made no attempt whatsoever to translate the Hebrew text, but simply revised earlier translations of the Latin Vulgate, they published, there were giants in the earth in those days. And also after that, when the sons of God came into the daughters of men, and they bare children unto them, the same became mighty men, which were of old men of renown. They were wrong. Thereafter, the Webster Bible parroted their predecessors. There were giants in the earth in those days. And also after that, when the sons of God came into the daughters of men, and they bore children to them, the same became mighty men, who were of old men of renown. The Common English Bible towed the same line. In those days, giants lived in the land. throughout the earth, and therefore afterward, when divine beings and human daughters had sexual relations and gave birth to children. These are the ancient heroes, famous men. Heroes and famous men, because, well, they have divine beings and human daughters had sexual relations. Now, I suspect you're noticing a trend. These were rendered one from another. To call them translations is to dishonor the word. They were copies. Now that we've considered the oldest English Bibles, let's see what time has wrought. Surely more recent translations will be more accurate, right? How about Young's literal translation? After Jehovah saith and before Jehovah seeth, we find the fallen ones were in the earth in those days. And then afterwards, when the sons of God came into the daughters of men, and they have born to them, they are the heroes who, from old, are men of name. Well, at least they got Shem translated literally.
They don't call them religious copy editors for nothing, you know.
You got it. There you go. The Good News translation was bad news. The authors of this modern paraphrase proposed, in those days and even later, there were giants on the earth who were the descendants of human women and the heavenly beings. They were great heroes and famous men of long ago. Well, the Good News translation is invalid in every conceivable way. There were no giants on the earth then or later, and God did not say or infer that they existed. The Good News translation completely disposed of the phrase sons of the Almighty and replaced it with heavenly beings. The only such beings are Malach, and they do not engage in sex. They are composed of light and serve as Yahweh's implements and messengers. They are not Yahweh's dildos. There are no heroes in the story. And God was not addressing fame. It is a shame that men sold this rubbish as the word of God.
It is.
In the Living Bible, we find in those days and even afterward, when the evil beings for the spirit world were sexually involved with human women, their children became giants, of whom so many legends are told. God, it's hard to imagine anything worse than the Good News translation. Well, that is until reading the Living Bible. Its rendition is despicable, wholly unjustified. It makes God out to be a nincompoop, nearly as dumb and perverted as his creation. Other than the opening phrase, in those days and even afterwards, which was out of order, the Living Bible didn't get anything right. Now, the message of the message became, as the Bible called the message. This was back then in the days, and also later, when there were giants in the land. The giants came from the union of the sons of God and the daughters of men. These were the mighty men of ancient lore, the famous ones. With all evidence to the contrary, we're still mired in the ignorance and carelessness of the Septuagint and Vulgate. Now, laughingly, the most recent English variation, the New Living Translation, they opine, in those days and for some time after, giant Nephilites lived on the earth. For whenever the sons of God had intercourse with women, they gave birth to children who became the heroes and the famous warriors of ancient times.
Unreal. This is insane. It's just as such a
on Nephilim as the Nephilites would have been better than calling them giants. It didn't fit either right. Nephilites, and they were giant Nephilites. That'd be funny.
You know, it's a shame. It's a shame because it's led people down this road to religion, to changing names, to taking Yahusha and becoming Jesus, and stopping at the foot of a pagan cross with blood running down.
How many changes can you make before what you have is so changed It isn't
nothing
uncommon.
It doesn't take
when
many.
Up to Malak,
would 300,000 and 182,000 words be sufficient?
It would be pretty.
Numbers of changes to mean it's
yes,
no longer for
it would,
even if it
yeah,
wasn't.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's the you know, people that that want to hang on to I'm a Christian, and I had a woman, like I said, now she's posting that she is a Christian. You know, and you know that's free will for you. You know, have at it. But I know 100% for a fact there was nobody named Jesus 2,000 years ago, and it doesn't take a genius to figure out the J sound didn't even exist until
the
15th
first person
century.
Named Jesus came to exist in among the Druid culture. They didn't have a written language, the Druids didn't, but the folklore that they communicated up to the time of the Romans who could write it down. They claimed that Jesus was the savior of their religion, where the horned one was God. So the first to have Jesus were the Druids. The first to write Jesus with a J and to conceive that name, it's first found in the third edition, right around 1650 of the King James Bible.
Yeah, King Ines.
That's when the name, right. So. So best I can say, you can say about Jesus, is that it was conceived in the 17th century, and it bears absolutely no resemblance whatsoever to Yahusha's name, and that it is wrong. That's the best you can say about it. 17th century name, that it is
and
totally
that would be
wrong,
the best.
And it bears,
other than
and
that,
it bears
know
absolutely
it really
no
comes
resemblance
from
to Yahusha. That's the best you can say.
The word but it comes
is that it is the only name that we know of that is close to it is the savior of the Druid religion where the horned one was God.
Well, I see it right in the Catholic Encyclopedia. I have a whole write-up on it, on a note on it, that the vote came down 157 to 161, where Hesus came in first and Krishna, the Eastern sun god, came in second. And it was because Constantine represented British interests. I mean, it's right in their own encyclopedia. We might want to look at the people that named their new Roman god. You know, I mean, that's what they said they did. That's what they said. You know, it had to come from somewhere, didn't it? You know, some people would say it's Jesus, but it was Hesus.
The New Living Translation. They ascribe their verbal diarrhea to the creator of the universe.
No, I can't. But you know, if you're Halo Ben Shikar, don't you want to make Yahweh's words look like a joke, like mockery?
They love to.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Perfect. Yeah, Christianity is the absolute perfect religion for Satan. Perfect. Couldn't be a better one.
It's the best counterfeit out there.
Because Islam, he's just overtly, Satan is just overtly Allah. And the only way for Satan to present himself as Satan and to be worshipped as Satan is to appeal to absolutely moronic people. I mean, you are appealing to total and complete ignoramuses with Islam. Christianity is a very clever counterfeit. And so with Christianity, it's Satan's ultimate prize because not only has it plagued the most people, you know, many, many times more than Islam, but it's the ploy that Satan used to be worshipped as the Lord Jesus Christ and Christianity is actually positions him as a somewhat believable replacement for God.
Yeah, right. I mean, people go through their whole lives without questioning it. They're willing
correct.
To die for it.
Correct.
Right. All the rest.
Correct. Yep.
Sure.
Now, I want to get to Jerome's letter because this is absolutely stunning, and then that's what we'll call it for an evening.
Okay. Go for it.
Okay.
Before we do that, can I bring something up real quick?
Just
it came up in the chat room. Someone was... We were talking about the idea of giants, and they brought up 1 Samuel chapter 17, verse 4, speaking of Goliath. And, you know, we talked earlier about the Masoretic and the difference. They weren't defending it. They were pointing out that it was a little more realistic. But I found something interesting. We talked earlier about the difference between the Masoretic and the Dead Sea Scrolls. According to the Masoretics, he was 6 cubits and a span. But the Dead Sea Scrolls tells us something different. According to the Dead Sea Scrolls, he was 4 cubits in a span. That's a difference of 3 feet. That puts him at roughly 6 foot tall.
Right.
Not unbelievable, even for that time period. And by that time period standard of height, that would be considered quite tall.
Yeah, of course.
But it's very realistic number.
We're not, today, there are people that are 7 feet tall. You know, Shaquille O'Neal is
upwards almost
to
8.
Shaquille O'Neal is a giant of a man. It has more to do with one's pituitary gland in terms of these things, and there is a height. I forget what the term is, but there is there's part of our nature that actually determines our height, and so the fact that there were absolutely some people taller than others has been true throughout all of human history. There are some dinosaurs that were taller than others. There are some dogs that are taller than others. You know, there are some horses that are taller than others. There are some men that are taller than others. And so to have one man be a giant among men is no different than Shaquille O'Neal and myself. You know, I'm a
but
boy
even then,
by comparison.
Goliath, by today's standards, would not be considered tall.
That is
he would have been about 6'2".
But
you know, he'd be considered slightly above average.
With the average person being right around 5 feet, then a 6'2 individual would
be a giant
to them. Right, exactly.
I know Fred pointed out earlier, he's 6'7". You know, by their standards, he would have been a giant. But,
he'd been bigger than Goliath.
Goliath would have been smaller than him.
Right.
Yeah, he went out there and stomped on Goliath. Yeah,
but that's a bit of a difference, you know. 2 cubits is a huge difference.
Yes,
you're talking about
the
height of a person, and that's the Masoretic versus the Dead Sea Scrolls right there.
Yeah. By the way, could you...
it's not a huge difference. It doesn't corrupt Yahweh's message, but it is
somebody,
a detail.
Right. Since when I'm saying there was no race of giants, and it's a natural thing for somebody, what about Goliath? Could you just email me that bit of research? Yes, please email me that bit of research, and I'll put it into the chapter, because I don't want people to lose based upon and this is the thing that gets people in a lot of trouble, and I'm not suggesting the person who asked this question in the forum was, in fact, you've said that they were not. A lot of people
the 6-cubit standard,
but there are so many people who will try to disprove something you say about Yahweh by looking for the exception. And that is always the wrong way to go. Always the wrong. The exceptions never prove the rule. There were no race of giants. There were men who were taller than other men. From the shorter men's perspective, they appeared giant. Okay. The Nephilim were not giants.
Okay. No.
Let's be clear. The purported translations have gone from bad to worse. The last four were even more despicable than the initial four. But that is the nature of things. Once something is perverted, it never gets better. Since we are now confronted by the collective malfeasance of religious translators, or should we say copyists, let's affirm something I discovered through research a number of years ago. The first English translations of the Bible were derived from Latin, not Greek, and most certainly not from Hebrew.
Wasn't that written on Pergamena? Pergamena, right? Okay.
They were all based upon the Roman Catholic Church's Vulgate, which itself was an amalgamation of old Latin manuscripts. While Jerome, actually, his name was Eusebius Hieronymus Sophronius. So, Eusebius Hieronymus Sophronius is the man's real name. How in the world they got Jerome out of that? I have no idea. Unless it's Hieronymus, which was his middle name. I guess you could somehow get from there to once the J was invented 1,000 years later, maybe. Anyway, he completed his blending process in 405 CE. But it's the letter that he wrote to Pope Damascus before it began that should have obliterated the credibility of Christianity. I want you to listen to what he wrote, and then I'm going to make a few comments on it. This is what the author of the Vulgate, which is the basis of all English translations, whether they want to admit it or not, the single most important person in the world, in the history of the world, as it relates to the Christian Bible. There is no one anywhere close to as important. His Vulgate was the exclusive Bible for all but the Copts and the Eastern Orthodox Church, the Greek Orthodox Church, for over 1,000 years. This is what he wrote his Pope before he began. If we are to pin our faith on the Latin text, it is for our opponents to tell us which text. For there are almost as many forms and texts as there are copies. If, on the other hand, we are to glean the truth from a comparison of many, why not go back to the original Greek and correct the mistakes introduced by inaccurate translators and the blundering alterations of confident but ignorant critics? And further, all that has been inserted or changed by copyists more asleep than awake. Now, the mission was the same as it would be for Islam's Quran 300 years later. Congeal many divergent texts into one authorized version so that it can be promoted as the inerrant word of God. If people are given choices, they tend to think independently. And that is not in the interest of those who wield power. If discrepancies are allowed, they lead to questions that the despots who claim divine sanction don't like answering. Jerome's mission was to eliminate the opposition by forestalling criticism. They would control the text, constraining people's access to God, interpreting it as they please, while claiming that it empowered them and them alone. And they would do so in their language, the tongue of the beast, Rome's Latin. Not Yahweh's Hebrew, not even Shaul's Greek. But that was just the motive for the crime of the millennia, and of course the consequence. And yet the most alarming part of this desecration wasn't even that the religion's most important individual relative to the documentation of its scriptures admitted that by the late 4th century there were already many forms, variations, mistakes, and changes in the Latin text comprising the Christian New Testament, while devastating to Christendom's credibility. The very foundation of the Roman Catholic Church and thus of Christendom and the veracity of its New Testament crumbles with the realization that the myriad of errors were the result of inaccurate translators and unduly confident and ignorant critics who blundered their way to copious alterations based upon a legacy of comatose copyists. It would have been game over for Christianity. It should have been. Seeking credibility, well, it destroyed it.
But Yara, here's the other thing about that. One of the things I find about Hillel is that he is very in your face.
Yes, he is.
You know, like here's the obvious stupid
right.
person,
Haunted.
And I'm going to flaunt how stupid you are.
I'm going to
right
tell you that he's demon-possessed. In the middle of his writing the Corinthians, and you won't understand it. And Islam, I will tell you that what's good for you is halal, even though it's my first name according to God, to Satan. Yeah,
and the arrogant son of the morning rising sun. Therefore, you're going to have Sunday worship of a Lord in front of a pagan cross. That, I get all that, but even worse, for what you're saying is actually in Revelation 2:12. Put there.
Yeah.
It's right there. To the messenger of the called out of Pergamos, write these things that relates to he who holds the double-edged sword. I'm aware of the place you live and the location of the seat of power of Satan. It's right there, and we know that the Latin Vulgate was written on pergamena, animal skins, parchment. And that's what they use to control the world. That's what they use to control God's word. It's right there. And so anybody that's going to stand there with Jerome and his Latin Vulgate is in complete opposition to the very book they're carrying around.
But can you imagine Jerome's admission to the Pope before he began was to pin their faith on a single Latin text that was an amalgamation of the errors that already existed in other Latin texts, and that his only hope was to make corrections based upon the Greek, but he admitted that the Greek texts were filled with errors as well. He's essentially saying, we're going to go into a swamp, and we're going to look for turds. And then we're going to choose which of those turds we like the best. And we're going to reorganize and choose between the turds.
That's what he said. That's what he said, and then we're going to sell it.
Oh, we're going to own it. It's going to be ours.
I know,
and
yet they
have control the world. We can
instead
control
of being
the world
thoughtful,
if you allow me to do this.
They're running around parroting this stuff word for word. I've heard it all my life.
Now,
it's
apart from the Greek Orthodox Church and the Copts in Egypt, the Vulgate served as the foundation of Roman Catholicism and Christianity for over 1,000 years. And now we know that the text was an amalgamation of errors, the product of ignorance, the result of blunders. Those who promoted it cannot and should not be trusted. If you believe them, if your faith is based upon the message they malign, you're a fool. But I have even worse news, something also unmasked by Jerome's letter to Pope Damascus. By the late 4th century, Greek copies of the Christian New Testament were so divergent from one another, not only had they already become unreliable, the only way to fix the problem was to distill the vast array of errors into a single amalgamation of those many mistakes. This obliterates the myth held by Christians that God would never allow his word to be corrupted. Sorry, but facts are facts. And as a result, he either allowed it to be corrupted or could do nothing to stop it. Now, while my last point is irrefutable, I feel compelled to ask the question, could Jerome resolve the inconsistencies and blunders in the Latin text of the New Testament by referring to the Greek manuscripts?
No.
The answer is no. No, not a chance.
No.
The New Testament Greek copyists worked in the same places for the same people at the same time as did those who butchered the Latin. They were equally incompetent. But unlike the Latin, where the divergent manuscripts were destroyed to hide the evidence of this crime, we have absolute and irrefutable proof that the Greek translators and copyists created many forms and variations which were laden with mistakes and changes, and that their many errors, alterations, and inconsistencies were the product of blundering and ignorant scribes. Over the past 50 years, 69 extant Greek copies of the Christian New Testament have been recovered and published, all dating to the late 1st through mid-4th century CE. And they are not only substantially different with respect to each other, and are over 300,000 variations between them and the early manuscripts found in, when you compare them to the Textus Receptus and then Nestle Allen, the blended text publishers claim underlie their English translations today. No doubt the Latin texts were irreconcilably corrupt, as Jerome admits, but the Greek manuscripts were already in far worse condition. Now,
you know,
the evidence in this regard is prolific
and irrefutable. So have you.
This realization completely obliterates Christianity's credibility. even if scribes of the 3rd and 4th centuries had accurately maintained the text they were given, it still wouldn't have mattered. A perfect copy of an imperfect document remains invalid. Half of the Christian New Testament was corrupt the moment the author's pen stained the papyrus. Paul's 13 letters are ungodly, invalid, and worse, demonic. As for the few books that might have held merit, Matanyah, Yahochanan, and Revelation, they have been all but destroyed by translators and copyists. A glaring example of this would be the story of the adulterous woman told in John 8, 1 through 11, the entire episode, including, "Let him who is without sin cast the first stone," was conceived in the 8th century CE. There's no reason.
Yeah, just added in there for no reason.
And
yeah.
I think it was added in there.
Its reason was to discredit
to oppose the Torah.
That is correct.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
There's
that's
no reason.
That's the reason they added it. It's quite clear.
But there, by that time, there were thousands of manuscripts. And it's not found in a single one of them. Not one. The entire account was made up because Christians wanted their God to contradict the Torah. Simply stated, the text of the Christian New Testament cannot be trusted. It has been in a constant state of degradation since it was first composed. This problem cannot be resolved or rationally refuted. And translations can be no more accurate than the underlying text, which is a jumbled mess of alterations. Now, there's a lot more to say. We've only begun to scratch the surface on this. I am convinced that what you're going to hear as we move into next week will be absolutely stunning, because we're going to go through the whole history of the Septuagint. We're going to go through the Hextapla project. We're going to listen to Origen and his struggles. We're going to go into Erasmus and what he wrote and how he composed the Textus Receptus. We're going to go into the specific purpose of the Great Bible by Henry VIII, of his daughter's The Bishop's Bible, and why both of them were written, why both of them were published, why John Calvin then decided that he was going to publish the Geneva Bible, why that led to the King James, and how each Bible since then has copied the King James, and how all of them are nothing more than the Septuagint copied into the Latin Vulgate, translated into English as it relates to what they call the Old Testament, and how the New Testament is nothing but Jerome's amalgamation of old Latin texts translated into English, and that the only intervening factor was not used.
Wait, so it's fair to say that Jerome's Vulgate is the original sin.
Yeah, you could say that.
He took a life from Marcion.
Yeah.
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 But he's the base of all.
Yeah. You're
going to learn a lot about alligator droppings, too.
I'm going to talk about those turds in the swamp. We're going to come right back to those turds in the swamp, because that's also
with people are without excuse with all this information today. I mean, they are without excuse. They really are.
It took me 5 days to pull all this together. So there's a lot of information out there.
No, that was a lot of it.
Well, yeah, I've only given you, 10% of it. There's a lot more.
Yeah, I'm sure. I know you, and I know you haven't even.
Oh yeah, we just get started here.
Yeah, what I do know, I wish you'd shoot that to me in an email though.
Sure.
One of the things that we do know for sure is that no matter how much reality is out there, the farm's out there, the farmer grew the stuff, and people want to bow down and worship food, but they don't want to go over there to the farm. People want to praise the food, but they don't want to go over there to the farm. People want to say, this food is almost like that food. It must be just as good, even though it's not true. And, when you lay these things out, and even in their own witness writings, you have Yahusha saying, you know, I came here as a fulfillment of Torah. You know, you can't you can't oppose one iota of it. I mean, that's what he says in Mach 1. You know, that's the closest.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
you
know,
I mean, the closest, the closest you have to being useful, by far, is Matanya.
Yeah.
And Yosha's words in Matanya, if you can filter them back out of the Greek into Hebrew, and if you don't make too big a deal about the Greek because he didn't speak Greek, but you can get those thoughts back into Hebrew, then, you know, I think you have something that is useful. It's not necessary, but it's useful. And by the way, all that the instruction on the mount says is that the Torah exists, the Torah is important, the Torah is the answer, the Torah is the doorway to life. And very few people will figure that out, and that anyone who tries to demean or discredit the Torah will be called lowly and little. So, he says, those who call me Lord, Lord, are Torahless, and he tells them, I do not know you. Get away from me.
Yeah.
So, all the instruction on the mount, which is, you know, that dominates the beginning of Matanya, it says, the Torah is everything. And so, if the Torah is everything, it's the doorway to life, read the Torah. And then, if you go back, you know, towards the end of it, the Olivet Discourse, which is you know, his prediction of the end times, it's a paraphrase of Zechariah. Yosha's commentary on Zechariah from beginning to end. You know, and if you look at the preceding chapter of Matanya, it is in essence Yeshayah. A 1 and 2. It's Yahweh's overt condemnation of religion.
We don't even have to go that far. We can go into Malachi. And we go into Malachi, and he says that the Torah will flow from his lips. Well, if the Torah isn't flowing from his lips, it can't be Yahusha, can it?
No.
Can't be the Maaseiah, because that's what he told him. He said, you're hiding my very you're hiding my very appearance in my Torah. He tells him that.
Correct.
And the Torah will flow from his lips. So, you know, he was the living, walking Torah. And if people want to say, well, then the Torah doesn't matter, they're saying Yahusha doesn't matter. But their religion sure does to them. It matters. And if they want to pick religion over reality, because that's what you got, reality versus religion.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Oh,
yeah.
Well, I mean, it, you know, that hand reaching down to a person that's responding. I mean, that, you know, that's the picture, right, Kirk? I mean, that's it.
You got it.
And so either at henna, and by the way, when was it changed? I mean, how do you know that was originally called a henna? I did have somebody ask that question.
The name of the, when you know, every Hebrew letter conveys a meaning, like, Yod, for example, the name of the letter translated
hand.
Is hand.
Yeah.
Right, hand.
Yeah, sure.
And so,
or
what
yod.
Is the word for hand? Yod. And
mm-hmm.
so, it is obvious that the letter was a yod hand. It still is a yod hand, and that somebody, for reasons I don't know, changed it from yod hand to yod, as if yod meant hand. And there are lots of places where you can read and say, yeah, the name of the letter was originally a yod. It's obviously with a yod, it's a hand, and it was changed to a yod. The same thing is true with him. You will read that it was changed. And the reason they know it was changed is because the person standing up and reaching up, the meaning of hey, if you look at any...
Pay attention.
Say, what's the meaning of this letter? It means to stand up and behold and pay attention. Their definition of the word is henna.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
The definition of the word is henna. The word, the letter was originally a henna. Yeah. In fact, K is just a shortened version of Hennig.
Yeah, so it's just straight off.
It's all in your face.
Yeah.
I mean, you just, you know, you got to do look.
Yeah.
Well, you're an artist, Kirk.
Yes.
This is why you're here, man.
I have an advantage. I'm sorry.
You do. Right. You do.
Yeah. Yeah. By the way, I've shared that.
Kurt,
several times.
You know, one of the things that is interesting in this chapter, I had the my first real opportunity to play out your observation, where if a word has a rosh in it, which is the person's head looking to the left, if the rosh is looking to a letter that is essential to either Yahweh's name or his title, then the connotation of the word is favorable. If the rosh is looking to something that is has nothing to do with Yahweh, or that is turned away from the letters that compose Yahweh's name or title, then the word is negative. And so I was dealing with ra'ah, which is rosh eleth hey, which is to see, to understand, to perceive, versus ra'ah, transliterated the same way, but now it's rosh ein hey. And so, and it's negative. It means evil.
Yeah.
And so what I did is just point out...
I don't know if it's conclusive, but it certainly happens most of the time that way.
Yeah, so it's...
Go ahead. I want
to
hear.
Here's an example. I said, so in the first one, which is to see, to envision, to perceive, to understand, ra'ah, with the middle letter being the aleph, which is the first letter in God's two favorite titles, Father, Ab, and El, God. Both is... one is... Eleth Beth, you know, the ram who leads us home,
mm-hmm.
and the other is Eleth Lamed, which is that the ram is also the sacrificial lamb is also the shepherd. And so in the case of the first one of Ra'ah as in to see, the person is looking at the lamb, at the ram representing God. And so it has a favorable connotation. And the second one, the person is looking at the eye, which means to perceive, and then at the person standing. So that person's perceptions are of man, and therefore it's evil.
Yeah, I did about 250 words, and it seems to bear it out for most all the time. There's always exceptions, I'm sure.
That's awesome.
It's an awesome insight. And in fact, if you wouldn't mind shooting me your, since you did more than just the three or four words that you sent me on that handwritten page.
It took me a little while. Let me dig them up and write them out.
Just send it to me by email. I'm going to Waco, Texas. I'm going to be with my son down in Texas for 3 or 4 days. And then I'm coming back, but I'll take a computer with me. I'll do a little writing while I'm down there. But, I did have an occasion to use it because I wanted to explain.
Of course.
Because I wrote I was translating Bavrashit 6:5, which is the verse after we're considering right now. And it had both the favorable and the unfavorable ra'ah,
mm-hmm.
which transliterated identically, written differently with the aleph versus the ain. And so I said, I'm just going to... going to play with this here and use the Kirkmeister technique. And
I think we just leave crumbs out there for us to find. I mean, it's just
I think so. Yeah, that was
like,
really powerful.
That's really cool. You know, there's got to be a reason you point things in certain directions.
I'll
have to do one on Dremel one of these days because you've got a leg going to the right. Walking forward.
Exactly. Yeah, my guess is it's going to be the same thing.
I expect you're going to find that overwhelmingly it to be that way.
Yeah.
Not
well, something that you pointed out is that in the Lamed, which is the shepherd's staff, that in Christendom and every place else, the staff is always where the crook is up. Mm-hmm. And the Lamed, in Yahweh's parlance, the crook and the staff is down. And you say, why would that be the case? Your insight today was brilliant.
Question.
Guys, we still got JB and Larry here. Why is the crooked part, the hook, if you will, of the shepherd's staff at a 45-degree angle, but pointed to the left and down in Lamed, as opposed to raised vertical and up as it is shown, you know, when it's in the hands of the Pope or somebody like that?
My only guess would be that in the downward position like that, it is active and being used.
And used for what? You're halfway home.
Leading the sheep. The shepherd used the hook of its staff.
Why does a shepherd's staff have that that rounded part in it, as opposed to just
to help guide the sheep?
Nope. You could guide the sheep.
You'd hook it around the neck to guide the sheep.
God does not guide us by hooking us around the neck.
No, but
if you have a sheep that has fallen down, that is injured, that's into a crap or how do you lift them up?
Just a simple ditch.
In a ditch. Or in a stream.
Yeah.
Or in a mud. How do you lift them up?
Yeah, hook them and pull them.
Staff.
That is correct. Yeah, hook them and pull them. That is why it's designed that way. Well, my Kirkster came up with that today.
Wow.
Well, not being a sheep herder.
Good call, Kirk.
We'll probably put it there.
That's just another reinforcement.
No, that makes a lot of sense.
This is the point of having an artist. This is the point, man.
This is the point.
That's why I love
that we have an artist on our team.
Yeah, that's indeed.
And by the way, I'm thinking about looking for a new job, so, and you're going to like
me. Sharpen your pencil.
I'm thinking about becoming a, maybe I'll sell my business, and I was thinking about becoming your IT man. And if I'm your IT man, you can bet you're in trouble.
I have no, Terry's the IT person in this family.
It's laughable that I could be somebody's IT man, let me tell you. But I could be for Kirk. Hey, Larry, do you know how to send an email? Yeah.
You don't have to tell the world, you know.
I gotta love you, Kirk.
I know, but you got too many attaboys today, so it's only fun to
attaboy, yeah, that's enough. You're not gonna hit next week.
Well anyway, yeah, next week we'll get to the rest of it. But it's important, you know, I had a woman today talking to me about what I believed, and I said, I don't care what anybody believes. She goes, what do you mean? The truth is, it's not about what you can believe. It's about what you can prove. And
right.
If you can prove it, and people want to hang on to nonsense,
right.
You know, and they're betting their souls
that's
on nonsense, on people
right.
that openly admit, like Jerome, that it's complete nonsense.
Right. Right.
You know, that sounded an awful lot like Falwell talking to you at lunch. Jerome's little speech.
Oh, it does. Yeah, it does.
Yeah, we know that.
Yeah, I
know that.
I mean, when I read that, I was floored. I said, how in the world could they be that? I mean, that's just like Satan again. I'm going to be right in your face. They were talking about controlling the world by controlling the text and to create a text that they could say is there. This is the only text. You can't choose between any others by amalgamizing a sea of mistakes by rearranging the turds in the swamp.
Yeah, and still, let's go back to Pergamena. That's what that is. They use Pergamena. That's Pergamos, and it's right there in the book they carry. Look, you are carrying the power seat of Halal ben Shikar in your hand, and it's named
correct.
After two sun goddesses, and it's completely inaccurate. And it's misleading on purpose. You can't take a Pesach dinner and turn it into the Last Supper unless you're intentionally doing that.
Yeah.
You just can't do it. It can't act.
You're either ignorant or you're irrational.
Right.
Two
right.
Lies.
I come because I'm the living Torah. I'm here to prove the Torah. And then we're going to say, well, no, he came to do away with it. Oh, wow. So the Torah flowed through his mouth, and he's here fulfilling the Korah in the heart of the Torah.
That's the whole idea of taking things out of context. If you remove, I came to fulfill it, and you stop right there, then it is irrational, it's ignorant, but it is possible to make the statement, so wait a minute, he came to fulfill it, therefore he did away with it. Now,
he fulfilled
what,
it.
That, by the way, that is not what fulfill means. And the next statement out of his mouth was, the previous one was, do not think I've come to do away with it. Don't think
or
I've
annul
come
it.
To end it.
In any way.
Yeah, annul it. Yeah. And then so if you read it in context, it's impossible to have the interpretation to fulfill as to annul. And then the next statement was, that there is that not a single jot was
jot,
the letter for the hand, the first letter in Yahweh's name, not a single one of those, or a single stroke on any of the other letters, the tittles, shall cease to exist or be done away with so long as the heavens and earth exist.
And they still exist.
Therefore, the only way that you can come to the Christian position is to ignore what came before it, ignore what came after it, and misinterpret what's in the middle. Now, when you're doing that, boy, you are really pushing every possible threshold of delusion.
You just don't want the truth at that point.
No, you just don't want it.
Yeah. Well, what you're gambling on, you know, I mean, you just pointed out, a man said we have a political position here, and we're going to basically control words that are corrupt.
We're going to control the text. We're going to control the text. We're going to pin our faith on the Latin text.
Yeah, which we know is completely corrupt. And
well,
we're
admitting that the translators and the scribes that create the Latin text, they created an absolute monstrosity. We're admitting that.
Yeah, and then people run around and they parrot it. You know, they have in Islam, they have these things called Quran readers. I'm sure you're aware of it.
Yeah.
Where they
sure.
can recite the Quran just like a monkey,
uh-huh.
you know, word for word.
From beginning to end,
looking.
By memory.
Yeah, that's the Barbs. The old history of the Barbs, you know, from centuries.
Well, they
centuries.
Just read it like a monkey, you know, like a parrot. And isn't this exactly what they teach you from start to finish if you go to Sunday school?
Sure. The Christians
are so impressed when someone sits there and quotes chapter and verse from their Bible. Yeah, the quote from King James. But Christians are so impressed when someone gets here, oh, well, John 3:16 says, or Matthew 5:4. They love that. Never mind whether their translation is correct, whether they have any understanding. They must know what they're talking about because they have it memorized word for word.
That's why I always
even John 3:16 is has to be taken out of context because he says, how do you say you believe in me and not do what I do? And he was doing the Torah. I mean, period.
Right.
Yeah.
According to
the
Torah.
Yeah, he was observing Torah. So, you know, people that say that the Torah's dead, the belief and faith is going to get me to that that life-eating, that farm where I can eat that food, this is irrational. But then this is religion. So what? You know, what's new?
Yeah, I'm going to bid you all good night and Shabbat.
Yeah,
I've got
early.
I've enjoyed this.
Early one tomorrow.
Great. Terrific stuff.
We're going to have a good time with this. This is essential because if the conclusions are validated, then God had no interest whatsoever. And I'm quoting from our
A book named after two sun goddesses. No kidding. Right, good foreshadowing of the seventh.
Thank you, Larry. Take care of y'all.
Talk to you guys next week.
All right. Bye-bye.
Good night, guys.